Now, you've come to kill us all.
That's right. A few of the men laughed.
How you gonna do that?
Freeway asked. With this. Evan reached for his cargo pocket. In the shadows, countless submachine guns rose and countless slides clanked. Freeway held up his arms for his men to calm down. Then he nodded at Evan to proceed. The Velcro patch on Evan's pocket flap gave way with a tearing noise that sounded unreasonably loud in the quiet church. Evan stuck his hand in the pocket and came out with a Snickers bar. There was a disbelieving silence. Evan peeled the wrapper and took a bite. He chewed, swallowed. He couldn't remember the last time he'd eaten a candy bar. He'd taken it from Joey's rucksack. One of the men cracked up, a deep rumble, and then the laughter spread. No amusement showed on Freeway's face. He skewered Evan with his black stare. This pendejo is fucking loco. We should skin him, someone called out from the darkness. Freeway flicked open his straight razor.
Not you. Me.
He started down the carpeted stairs, those tattooed eyes never leaving Evan.
Big dogs gotta eat.
Evan took another bite. I'm not done yet, he said through a full mouth.
You wanna finish your candy bar?
Freeway said. Evan nodded. Freeway kept the razor open, but he crossed his arms, the blade rising next to the grooved ball of his biceps.
Okay, he said. Your last meal.
Evan chewed some more, then popped the last bite into his mouth. He crumpled up the wrapper, let it fall from his hand onto the floor. Freeway started forward, but Evan held up a finger as he cleared the caramel from his molars with his tongue. He strained his ears, but heard nothing. A spark of concern flared to life in his stomach. He was out of time. And then he sensed it. The air vibrating with a distant thrumming. It grew louder. Freeway took a half step back toward the altar, his eyes pulling up to the ceiling. The other men looked spooked, regarding the church walls around them. The thumping grew louder. A few shards of stained glass fell from the high frame. From beyond the front door came the unmistakable sound of sniper rounds lasering through the air. Then the thud of falling bodies. Evan said to Freeway, "You might want to go see about that." The steel front door blew open, devil horns sailing back through the vestibule, the top of his head blown off. A black hawk whooped down at the entrance, gusting wind through the nave. Operators in balaclavas spilled out with military precision, subguns raised, firing through the doorway, dropping the first ranks of gang members. The inadvertent cavalry, right on time. As the gang members scrambled to return fire, Evan walked to the side of the church where the stolen goods were stored. Ducking behind a head-high pallet, he dumped out a booster bag, emptying a load of RFID-tagged Versace shirts onto the floor. Then he climbed into the roomy duffel and zipped himself in. The inside, lined with thick space blanket foil, crinkled around him. His own miniature Faraday cage. It would mute the GPS signal emanating from his stomach. The sounds from the church nave were apocalyptic. Cracking rounds, panicked shrieks, crashing bodies, wet bellowing, splintering wood. A full-fledged urban firefight. Two birds, one stone. At last, the frequency of gunfire slowed. A prayer in Spanish was cut off with a last report. The smell of cordite reached Evan even here, hidden in the bag. He heard heavy boots moving through the nave, and then Thornhill said, "Clear!" Jesus F. Christ! Who knew we were wading into Fallujah? Van Sciver's deep voice carried to Evan. What a shit show. How many did we lose? Candy's voice said, "Three. I count three." In the darkness of the booster bag, Evan thought, 20 dead. 5 to go. Van Sciver's voice came again. "Where's X?" Thornhill again. "I don't know. The GPS signal. It vanished."
Vanished? We had at least 4 more minutes by my count. I don't know what to tell you. How about the blood trail there at the back of the altar? One of the gang members. I saw him stumble out. It wasn't X. Get me optics on thermal signatures in the building. Now! Shuffling boots. Then Thornhill said, there's nothing on premises except the dead bodies, and we've looked under them. A beat. I think homeboy played us. A few seconds of silence. Then Van Sciver swore loudly, the sharp syllable booming off the walls. Evan had not heard him lose his cool. Not since their Pride House days. In his booster bag tucked behind the pallet, he stayed perfectly still. Van Sciver said, get our bodies out of here. We need to lay down a cover story. Gang violence, cartel involvement, whatever. We were never here. Thornhill issued orders over a radio, and then more boots thumped in, the sounds of corpses being dragged. The floorboards groaned as someone drew near. They groaned again, nearer yet. Evan felt faint tremors through the foundation. Then Van Sciver's voice came, no more than 10 feet away. No, he said. And then, no. And once again, with an undercurrent of worry, no. A phone call. Van Sciver had stepped to the side of the church for privacy. Okay, he said, we won't. Not a trace. A beat, and then, I understand the Blackhawk is high profile. We won't use it again. This was our best shot. Another pause. Not very well. Van Sciver took another step, so close now that Evan could hear him breathing. I understand he's the only connective tissue. But 1997 is a long ways back. Evan could hear the voice on the other end of the line now. Not the words, but the tone. Firm and confident, with a hidden seam of rage. Van Sciver replied, yes, Mr. President. The phone call terminated with a click. Van Sciver exhaled through what sounded like clenched teeth. He shifted his weight, the floorboards answering. Then his steps headed out. A moment later, Evan heard the Blackhawk rotors spin up and the helo lift off. The sound faded. There came an instant of peace. And then sirens wailed faintly somewhere in the night. Evan unzipped himself, releasing the humidity of the booster bag. He climbed out. The air tasted of smoke and blood. Bodies covered the nave, folded over pews, sprawled on the floor, heaped against the walls. No sign of freeway. The sirens were louder now. Bullets riddled the old wooden altarpiece. Blood painted the Virgin Mary's forehead. An Ash Wednesday smudge. The arc of the cast-off spatter pointed to the right side. Evan followed, mounting the carpeted steps. A brief hall behind the altar led to a rear door. He stepped out into the crisp night. Drops of blood left a fairy tale trail out of the back alley. Evan followed them. He came to the street and crossed it as a swarm of cop cars screeched up to the front of the church. A crowd had gathered, and he melted into its embrace. More crimson drops on the sidewalk, the transfer pattern of a handprint on a street lamp, a red dab stained a flyer by the bodega with the plywood-covered window. The bodega sign was turned to closed. Evan slipped inside. The owner stood behind the cash register, trembling. Evan said, Larigate. The owner scrambled out through the front door. The blood drops were thicker now on the floor tiles. Evan followed them up the aisle and into the back courtyard. Freeway was leaning against a metal post, clutching a gunshot wound in his side. His other hand held the straight razor. He firmed his posture and held the blade to the side. Those black eyes picked across Evan. You're stupid to come here with no weapon. Maybe so, Evan said. But I have one advantage. Freeway bared his teeth. What's that? I don't have metal in my face. He hit Freeway with a haymaker cross. The studs moored the skin.
There was a great tearing and a drool knot of saliva. The straight razor clattered to the concrete as Freeway hit his knees, the wreckage of his face pouring through his fingers. Evan picked up the razor from the ground, looked down at Freeway.
"Look what I found," he said. "A weapon."
70. Negative space. Sitting at his kitchen island, Evan fanned through Van Sciver's red notebook again. He stared at the scrawl standing out in relief from the pencil-blackened page in the middle. 6-14-14, Dark Road 32. He'd returned to Castle Heights to make a few arrangements, laying the groundwork for the battle to come. In light of the conversation he'd overheard in the church, he needed to check the notebook again. Staring at the words now, he sensed the puzzle piece slide into place. He walked past the living wall, catching a whiff of mint, and stepped through one of the south-facing sliding doors onto the balcony. He crouched before a square planter at the edge that held a variety of succulents and slid clear an inset panel. It hid a camouflage backpack, which he removed and carried inside. He returned to the island, the notebook page looking up at him, the scrawl rendered clear in the negative space. Joey came down from the loft, ready to go. She paused and took him in sitting over the notebook. "You know what it means now," she said. He nodded absent-mindedly. "You gonna share?" Evan shut the notebook as if that could somehow contain the problem within. "Yeah. 202-456-1414 is the main switchboard for the West Wing," he said. She processed this. "And Dark Road?" "A code word. Presumably to kick the caller to a security command post in the White House." "And the 32, she said. "That's an extension." He nodded again. "That goes to who?" she asked. He looked at her. "Holy hell," she said. "Indeed." "Why?" she said. "Why would he be involved?" Evan rubbed his face. Again he pictured Jack dropping him off at departures at Dulles back when Evan was a 19-year-old kid. Jack's hand on his forearm, not wanting to let him go. Evan said, "When I was in that booster bag, I heard Van Sciver reference 1997. "And?" "That was the year of my first mission." "What was it?" "I can't tell you that," he said. "But in 1997, President Bennett was the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy at the DOD. "And the orphan program existed under the Department of Defense's umbrella," Joey said slowly, putting it together. All at once, the rationale for the shift of the program's aim under Van Sciver's leadership came clearer. So did the sudden push to exterminate orphans. Evan, most of all. He didn't just know where the bodies were buried. He'd buried most of them himself. Joey said, "So Bennett greenlit your first mission?" "Yes. And as the leader of the free world now, he wants to clean up any trace of his involvement in non-sanctioned activities. Any trace of me." Joey set her elbows on the island and leaned over, her eyes wide. "Do you get what this means? You've got dirt on the President of the United States." Evan spun back in time to his 12th year, riding in Jack's truck, Jack describing the program to him for the first time in that 10-grit voice. "You'll be a cutout man, fully expendable. You'll know only your silo. Nothing damaging. If you're caught, you're on your own. They will torture you to pieces, and you can give up all the information you have, because none of it is useful." "I know the who," Evan said, "but not the what."
"What do you mean?"
"I know what I did in 97, but I don't know anything else, or how it connects to Bennett." He looked down at the red notebook as if it could tell him something. "But someday, when this is all over, I'm gonna find out."
"When what's all over?"
"Come and I'll show you. He shouldered the camo pack, grabbed the keys, and started for the door. The Vegas Strip rose from the flat desert earth like a parade, a brassy roar of faux daylight. Evan kept on the I-15, let the bombastic display fly by on the right-hand side, Joey's head swiveling to watch it pass. For a few minutes, it was impossible to tell that it was nearly 4 in the morning. But as the glow faded in the rear view and the stars reasserted themselves overhead, it became clear that they were driving through deepest night. Joey worked her speed cube without looking. Whenever Evan glanced over, he saw that she was once again spinning it into patterns from memory. The clacking of the cube carried them across the dark miles. Once the Grand Boulevard was far behind them, Evan pulled over and wound his way through back roads. The pickup rumbled onto a dirt road that narrowed into a sagebrush-crowded trail. At last he pulled over at a makeshift range. Tattered targets fluttered on bales of hay beneath the moonlight, Monet gone bellicose. When they stepped out of the truck, shell casings jangled underfoot. "What are we doing here?" Joey asked. "Planning." "For what?" "For the next time I eat something and light up the GPS in my stomach." "Now Van Sciver will know it's a trap," she said. "Right. So he'll spring a trap on our trap. And we'll spring a trap on the trap he's springing on our trap." She squinted at him through the darkness. He felt a flash of affection for this girl, this mission that had blown through his life like an F-5 tornado. He thought of his words to Jack in their final conversation. "I wouldn't trade knowing you for anything." But he couldn't make them come out of his mouth now, in this context. They stopped somewhere in his throat, locked down behind his expressionless stare. Far below, a solitary set of headlights blazed through the night. Evan and Joey watched them climb the dune, disappearing at intervals on the switchbacks. Then a dually truck shuddered up beside Evan's F-150, rocking to a halt. The door kicked open, and Tommy Stojak slid out of the driver's seat and landed unevenly. His ankles were shot from too many parachute jumps, as were his knees and hips. The damage gave him a loose-limbed walk that called to mind a movie cowboy. "Shit, brother. I was way out at the ranch prepping for SHOT Show when you called. Just had time to wash pits and parts and haul ass out, but here I is." He and Evan clasped hands in greeting, and then Tommy looked over at Joey, his biker mustache shifting as he assessed her. "This the one you told me about?" "It is." Tommy gave an approving nod. "She looks lined out." Joey said, "Thanks. For a 16-year-old broad, I mean." Joey smiled flatly. "Thanks." Tommy stroked his mustache, cocked his head at Evan. "Last we broke bread, I said if you needed me, give a holler. You hit a wall, and you figured what the fuck?"
"I figured exactly that," Evan said.
"Well, I can't scoot like I used to, but I can still loot and shoot. I know you well enough to know if you're calling in air support, you're up against it."
"Yes," Evan said.
"Well, with what you're asking, I'm gonna need you to make more words come out your mouth hole."
"They're trying to kill me, and they're trying to kill her."
A long pause ensued as Tommy chewed on this. "You, I understand," he said finally, his mustache arranging itself into a smirk. "But still, I suppose it'd be unset for me to sit back and let a good piece of gear like you hit a meat grinder. So, what services of mine are required?"
Evan said, "Your research for DARPA." Tommy's eyes gleamed.
"Before we get to putting metal on meat, I'd best know what we're looking at so I can see if it falls within my moral purview. So if you want me to put on the big boy pants and the Houdini hat, let's go back to the shop. I'll drink a hot cup of shut the fuck up, and you read me in on what's readinable."
"Wait a minute," Joey said. "DARPA?" She looked from Evan to Tommy. "What are you guys talking about?"
"What are we talking about?"
Tommy smiled, showing off the gap in his front teeth.
"We're talking about some Harry Potter shit."
71.
bring the thunder. A cup of yerba mate tea and a plate of fresh-sliced mango, both lovingly served, both untouched, sat before Evan on the low coffee table of the front room. Benito and Javier Orellana occupied the lopsided couch opposite him. Benito said, "My son and I, we don't know how to express our..." Evan said, "No need." Javier folded his hands. The forearm tattoo he had recently started, that elaborate M for Mara Salvatrucha, had taken a new direction. Rather than spelling out the gang's name, it now said Madre. The last four letters looked brand new, hours old. They were interwoven with vines and flowers. Javier saw Evan looking and shifted self-consciously.
"You said we can remake ourselves however we want. So I figured, why not start here?"
Benito's eyes welled up, and Evan was worried the old man might start to cry. Evan didn't have time for that. He looked over their shoulders and out the front window to the brim of the valley of the vast raised lot. Sounds of construction carried up the slope. At the edge of the lot, way down by the 10 freeway, the fifth story of the emergent building thrust into view. It had been roughly framed out now, workers scrambling in the cross-section of the visible top floors. Their union shifts would end in 2 hours, and then the lot would be deserted for the night.
"How can we repay you for what you've done?" Benito asked.
"There is one thing," Evan said. "Whatever you ask," Javier said,
"I'll do."
Beside him, his father tensed at the edge of the couch cushion.
"Find someone who needs me," Evan said,
"like you did. It doesn't matter how long it takes. Find someone who's desperate, who's got no way out, and give them my number. 1-855-2-NOWHERE. Both men nodded. "You tell them about me. Tell them I'll be there on the other end of the phone."
Benito said, "The Nowhere Man."
"That's right." As Evan rose, Javier found his feet quickly.
"Sir,"
he said, the word sounding ridiculous and old-fashioned in his mouth.
"Why do you do this?"
Evan looked at the floor. An image came to him. Joey standing in front of that house in the Phoenix heat, gun in hand, staring down a woman on a porch swing, and then handing the pistol back to him, unfired. The words were surprisingly hard to say, but he fought them out. "Because everyone deserves a second chance." Javier extended his hand, that Madre tattoo bleeding and raw and beautiful.
"I'll do it. I'll find someone else."
Evan shook his hand. The front door banged in, Tommy shouldering through, gripping a Hardig case in each hand. Javier and Benito looked at the stranger with alarm.
"Also," Tommy said, "we're gonna need to borrow your roof."
At the base of the sloped lot, Evan and Joey stood between a tower crane and a hydraulic torque wrench, staring up at the five-story development. Beyond the tall concrete wall to their side, afternoon rush-hour traffic hummed by. The workers had retired for the night. The six-acre blind spot provided an unlikely patch of privacy in the heart of Los Angeles. Upslope, the lot ended at a street, but the houses beyond, including Benito Orellana's, were not visible. The construction platform's lift, an orange cage half the size of a shipping container, had been lowered for the workday's end. Joey stepped forward, rocked it with her foot. It didn't give. Then she leaned back and appraised the steel bones of the building to be. "Which route?" Evan asked. Joey squinted. Then she raised an arm, pointing.
"There, to there, to there. See that I-beam?
Third floor, then across. Up that rise. There, there, and then up." Evan visualized the path. "How do you know?"
"Geometry."
"Okay," he said. "Now you're done. Let's get you somewhere safe." "You're kidding, right?"
"No,"
he said. "You're out. Me and Tommy will handle it from here."
"You and Tommy are going to have your hands full. You need me. Any way you cut it, it's a three-man plan."
He knew she was right.
Evan could handle 5 freelancers, skilled as they were, but not 3 orphans on top of that. He leaned against the blocky 1980 Lincoln Town Car they'd driven down the slope. Beside it, the lowered claw of a backhoe nodded downward, a crane sipping from a lake. Joey looked up to the top of the building, the breeze lifting her hair, a wisp catching in the corner of her mouth. "You laid it out yourself. Van Sciver won't deploy drones on U.S. soil. The president ordered him not to use choppers anymore. We can control some of the variables." "This is different," Evan said. "I'm not leaving you to this alone. And you only got a few more hours before those GPS chips break down in your stomach. You'd better eat something and throw a signal while you still can." She reached into her jacket pocket, pulled out a Snickers bar, and wiggled it back and forth. He didn't smile, but that didn't seem to faze her. "I'm not going anywhere," she said, "so quit wasting time. Joey, it's too dangerous. You're right. Anywhere I go, he'll find me. You know that. You know it in your gut. I will never be safe until he's dead. And you know you need me to make this plan work." Evan studied her stubborn face. Then he came off the car and pointed at her, trying to keep the exasperation from his voice. "After this, you're out."
"I'm out. Some other life."
Her smile held equal parts trepidation and excitement. "Ponytails and white picket fences. The minute this operation goes live, I'll just sail out of here," she said. "I'll be fine." She paused. "But you? I don't see you getting out of this." He listened to the wind whistle through the I-beams overhead. Jack, paraphrasing the German field marshal and the Scottish poet, used to say, "Even the best laid plan can't survive the first fired bullet." Evan had taken his measurements, charted his course, laid his plans. He had escape routes planned and off-the-books emergency medical support on standby. Despite all that, he knew Joey was right, that this man-made valley could well prove to be his grave. Maybe not. He placed a wire-thin saber radio in her hand. The bone phone would pick up her voice and allow her to listen directly through her jaw. She said, "We could still get into that ugly-ass town car and just drive away." A wistful smile tugged at his lips. He shook his head. The breeze blew across her face, and she swept her hair back. "He's gonna come with everything he has, and he's gonna kill you like he has everyone else. You think Jack would want this?" "It's not just about Jack anymore. It's about everyone else who Van Sciver's got in his sights." His throat was dry. "It's about you, Joey." He'd said it louder than he'd intended, and with anger, though where the anger came from, he wasn't sure. Her eyes moistened. She looked away sharply. For a time, there was only the breeze. Then she said,
"Josephine."
"I'm sorry?"
"My name. You wanted to know my full name."
Her eyes darted to his face, and then away again.
"There it is."
Beyond the concrete rise, vehicles whipped by on the freeway, oblivious people leading ordinary lives, some charmed, some not. On this side of the wall, there was only Evan and a 16-year-old girl, trying their best to say goodbye. Joey lifted the forgotten Snickers bar from her side and tossed it to him. She took a deep breath.
"Okay,"
she said. "Let's bring the thunder." 72. Thin the Herd. The freelancers came in first, and they came by foot. The 5 men wound their way toward the valley in a tightening spiral, a snake coiling. Former Secret Service agents, they brought the tools of the trade designed to protect the most important human on Earth. Electronic noses for hazardous chemicals and biologicals, bomb detection devices, thermal imaging handhelds. Though it wasn't yet dusk, they had infrared goggles around their necks, ready for nightfall. After safing the surrounding blocks, they meticulously combed through every square foot of the valley,
communicating with radio earpieces, ensuring that anything within view of the construction site below was clear. Each man wore a Raytheon Boomerang Warrior on his shoulder, an electronic sniper detection system. Developed for Iraq, it could pinpoint the position of any enemy shooter within sight lines up to 3,000 feet away. Two of the freelancers rolled out, hiking back up the slope, giving a final check, and disappearing from view. 10 minutes passed. And then two Chevy Tahoes with tinted windows, steel plate-reinforced doors, and laminated bullet-resistant glass coasted down the slope. They parked at the base of the construction building in front of the porta-potties. Van Sciver got out, swollen with body armor, and stood behind the shield of the door. Candy and Thornhill strayed a bit farther, the freelancers holding a loose perimeter around them, facing outward. The operators now held FN SCAR 17S Spec Ops rifles, scopes riding the hard-chromed bores. Menacing guns. They looked like they had an appetite of their own. Van Sciver cast his gaze around. "Well," he said, "we're here." Thornhill scanned the rim of the valley. "Think he'll show?" Van Sciver's damaged right eye watered in the faint breeze. He wristed a tear off the edge of his lid. "He called the meet." "Then where is he?" one of the freelancers asked. "The GPS signal from the microchips is long gone," Thornhill said. "It's up to our own selves." The faint noise of a car engine rose above the muted hum of freeway traffic behind the concrete wall. The freelancers oriented to the street above. The noise of the motor grew louder. The men raised their weapons. A white Lincoln Town Car plowed over the brim of the valley, plummeting down the slope at them. Already the men were firing, riddling the windshield and hood with bullets. The town car bumped over the irregular terrain, slowing but still pulled by gravity. The men shot out the tires, aerated the engine block. The car slowed. Glancing off a backhoe and nodding to a stop 20 yards away. Two of the freelancers raced forward, lasering rounds through the shattered maw of the windshield. The first checked the car's interior cautiously over the top of his weapon. "Clear. No bodies." The other wandered down the vehicle. "No explosives either. It's a test." 20 yards back, still protected by their respective armor-plated doors, Van Sciver and Candy had already spun around to assess less predictable angles of attack that the diversion had been designed to open up. Van Sciver's gaze snagged on the side of the under-construction building, the platform lift waiting by the top floor. "He's there," he said. "We would have picked up thermal, sir," the freelancer said. Van Sciver pointed at the mounted platform's lift control. Thornhill jogged over to the base of the building, keeping his eyes above, and clicked to lower the lift. Nothing happened. The bottom control mechanism had been sabotaged. All five freelancers raised their scars in concert, covering the building's fifth floor. Van Sciver said, "Get me sat imagery." Keeping his rifle pointed up, one of the freelancers shuffled over and passed a handheld to Van Sciver, who remained wedged behind the armored door of the Tahoe. Van Sciver zoomed in on the bird's-eye footage of the building, waiting for the clarity to resolve. Stiff, canvas-like fabric was heaped a few feet from the open edge of the fifth floor. "He's hiding beneath a Faraday cage cloak," Van Sciver said. "The metallized fabric blocked your thermal imaging. It's not distinct enough to red flag on the satellite footage unless you know to look for it." "He's holding high ground," Candy observed, "and we've got no good vantage point." Van Sciver stared at the concrete wall framing the 10 freeway. Posting up on the fifth floor was a smart move on X's part. The open top level was in full view of the freeway and the buildings across from it. They couldn't come at him with force or numbers without inviting 400 eyewitnesses every second to the party. "What's he waiting for?" one of the freelancers asked through clenched teeth. "For me to step clear of the armored vehicle and give him an angle," Van Sciver said. "But I'm not going to do that." With a gloved hand, the freelancer swiped sweat from his brow. "So what are we going to do? We can't get up there." Van Sciver's lopsided stare locked on Thornhill. An understanding passed between them. Thornhill's smile lit up his face. Van Sciver said, "Fetch."
Thornhill snugged his radio earpiece firmly into place. Then he sprinted forward, leaping from a wheelbarrow onto the roof of a porta-potty. Then he hurtled through the air, clamping onto the exposed ledge of the second floor. The freelancers watched in awe as he scurried up the face of the building, frog-leaping from an exposed window frame to a 4x4 to a concrete ledge. He used a stubbed-out piece of rebar on the third floor as a gymnast high bar, rotating to fly onto a vertical I-beam holding up the fourth story. Mere feet from the edge of the fifth floor, he paused on his new perch, shoulder muscles bunched, legs bent, braced for a lunge. He turned to take in the others below, giving them a moment to drink in the glory of what he'd just done. Then he refocused. His body pulsed as he slide-jumped up the I-beam's length. He gripped the cap plate with both hands and readied for the final leap that would bring him across the lip to the top of the building. But the cap plate moved with him. It jerked free of the I-beam and hammered back against his chest, striking the muscle with a thud. One of the high-strength carriage bolts designed to secure the cap plate to the I-beam's flange sailed past his cheek. The other three bolts rattled in their boreholes, unsecured. He clasped the cap plate to his chest, a weightless instant. His eyes were level with the poured slab of the fifth floor, and he saw the puddle of the Faraday cloak there almost within reach. The cloak's edge was lipped up, a face peering out from the makeshift burrow. Not X's, but the girl's. She raised a hand, wiggled the fingers in a little wave. "It's the girl," Thornhill said, his voice, hushed with disbelief, carried through his radio earpiece. He floated there an instant, clutching the cap plate. And then he fell with it. 5 stories whipped by, a whirligig view of construction gear, matchbox cars drifting through 14 lanes of traffic beyond the concrete wall, his compatriots staring up with horrified expressions. He went through the roof of the porta-potty. As he vanished, 1 sturdy fiberglass wall sheared off his left leg at the hip, painting the dirt with arterial spray. A moment of stunned silence. Van Sciver tried to swallow, but his throat clutched up. One of his finest tools, a weaponized extension of himself as the director of the orphan program, had just been splattered all over an outdoor shitter. Candy moved first, diving into the Tahoe. Van Sciver's muscle memory snapped him back into focus. Raising his FNX-45, he set his elbows in the fork of the armored door and aimed upslope. He said, "It's another decoy." The freelancers spread out, aiming in various directions, up the partially constructed building, across the valley, at the freeway wall. The lead man squeezed off a few shots, nicking the edge of the fifth floor to hold Joey at bay. The wind reached a howl in the bare beams of the structure. "Fuck," Van Sciver said. "Where is—" 20 yards away, the trunk of the white Lincoln Town Car popped open, and Evan burst up in a kneeling stance, a Faraday cloak sloughing off his shoulders. He shot 2 freelancers through the heads before they could orient to the movement. The third managed to, and took a round through the mouth. The remaining pair of freelancers wheeled on Evan, their rifles biting coaster-sized chunks of metal from the town car's grill. Evan spilled onto the dirt behind the town car and flattened to the ground. The big block engine of the old Lincoln protected him, at least as well as it had on the car's descent into the valley. But time was not on his side. The reports were deafening. He clicked his bone phone on. "Joey, jump now and get gone." She'd played bait one last time. Her only job now was to vanish. Evan had set her up with the camouflage backpack he kept hidden in the planter on his balcony. The pack was stuffed with a base-jumping parachute. A running leap off the backside of the fifth-floor platform would allow her to steer across the immense freeway, land in the confusion of alleys and buildings across from it, and disappear. Evan risked a peek around the rear fender. He spotted Candy rolling out of the Tahoe's back seat with a shotgun an instant before one of Van Sciver's bullets shattered out the brake light inches from his face. He whipped back, felt the town car shuddering, absorbing round after round as the freelancers advanced. He spoke again into the bone phone. "Tommy, you're up." Flattening against the car, he rested the back of his head to the metal,
pinned down to a space the width of a rear bumper. Tommy emerged from the umbra beside Benito Oriana's chimney and bellied to the edge of the roof where his two Hardig cases waited, lids raised. The first held optical sighting technology, and a half-dozen eight-ball cameras nestled in the foam lining. He had no direct sightline onto the valley or the construction site below. He plucked free the first eight-ball and hurled it across the street. It bounced once, disappearing over the lip and rolling downslope, its 360-degree panorama replicated on the laptop screen. The round camera landed behind a backhoe, providing him a view of the dirt slope beyond, the clear blue sky, and nothing else. He threw the second and third eight-ball cameras in rapid succession. The second landed in a ditch, but the third stopped three-fourths of the way down the slope, providing a lovely perspective on the mayhem unfolding at the construction site below. Two freelancers stood in the open, but Van Sciver and Candy were wisely tucked away, using the armored SUVs for cover. That was okay. Tommy could still thin the herd for Evan. In front of the second Hardig case, an assembled Barrett M107 awaited him. He'd chosen the self-loader for rapidity. Once this shit went down, the boys below would be scrambling every which way, all asses and elbows. Firming the 50 cal into position, he lay at the roof's edge. He would have preferred a spotter, but given the sensitive nature of the mission and Evan's wishes, no one else could be in the loop. It would be a hell of a challenge to crank off two shots in rapid succession, especially since he had to steer the first one in. Microelectronics distorted the shape of the round after it left the barrel, changing its line of flight. As good as Tommy was, and as state-of-the-art the technology, there was only so much guidance you could lay on a Projo hurtling along at 2,850 feet a second. He checked the optics screen, using the eight-ball's feed to index locations for landmarks. Then he set his eye to the scope and prepared to bend a bullet in midair. Evan read the freelancer's shadows. That was all he could do. Braced against the rear bumper of the town car, he watched them stretch alongside him, upraised rifles clearly silhouetted. If he rolled to either side, he presented himself not just to them, but to Van Sciver and Candy, who were posted up in the SUVs 20 yards beyond. "We got you pinned behind the car and the little girl stuck up on the roof," Van Sciver shouted. "Even if she has a rifle, she can't cover you. Not from there. I've seen her shoot." Tommy still hadn't announced himself. The technology was fledgling. Evan had always known that any help would be a literal and figurative long shot. Cast forward, the shadows on the earth inched past his position, crammed behind the town car. They advanced in unison. Any second now, Evan would have to make the choice to move one way or the other. He decided to expose his right side. He could shoot with either hand, but was stronger with his left, so if an arm went down, better the right one. If he was lucky enough to merely take a round to the limb. He sucked in a breath, tensed his legs, counted down. 3, 2. The whine of a projectile was followed by a snap on the wind. The shadow to Evan's right crumpled, a body falling just out of sight by the side of the town car. A bright spill oozed into view by Evan's boots, staining the dirt. 24 down. 1 left. The last freelancer pulled back. Holy shit! How the fuck? Evan popped up to drop him, but Candy was waiting by the other Tahoe. She unleashed the shotgun, and Evan dropped an instant before the scatter shot hit the trunk. The trunk slammed down, nearly sawing off his chin, and banged back up. The edge clipped his shooting hand, the Ares flying out of reach, landing 10 yards in the open. Slumped low at the rear fender, he panted in the dirt. The bullet holes in the raised trunk cut circles of light in the shadow thrown on the ground behind Evan. He rose to reach for a backup pistol in the trunk, but Candy fired again, the slugs tearing through the metal, whistling past his torso. The trunk slammed down, banging his forearm. Evan hit the ground again, dust puffing into his mouth. The freelancer was crawling away. Evan could see him for an instant beneath the carriage of the town car. Another of Tommy's rounds whined in and bit a divot from the dirt 4 inches from the freelancer's pinky finger.
The man bellowed and rolled away, grabbing at the screen of the boomerang warrior unit mounted on his shoulder. A third round clipped the butt of the man's slung rifle, kicking it into a hula hoop spin around his shoulder. He dove behind a heap of gravel next to the tower crane, shouting, "How the hell does he see me? I'm showing nothing in our line of sight!" Van Sciver's calm, deep voice rode the breeze. "Check for cameras." A moment later, the boomerang warrior's picking up a remote surveillance unit in the valley with an angle on us. Evan debated going again for the backup Ares in the ravaged trunk of the town car, but there were enough holes now that the raised metal no longer offered protection. It would be like standing behind a screen door. He got off a glance around the punctured rear tire, catching Van Sciver's thick arm reaching past the Tahoe's door to haul in a fallen FN SCAR 17S. Even without an earpiece, Evan heard Van Sciver say, "Send me the coordinates." The simple directive landed on Evan like something physical, the weight of impending defeat. 20 seconds passed, an eternity in a battle. Then the rifle cracked, and Evan saw metal shards jump up from the earth upslope, glinting in the dying sunlight. Van Sciver's voice carried, ghostly across the dusty expanse. "We are clear. Candy, haul ass up there and find who's behind that camera." At the town car's rear bumper, Evan heard Tommy's voice come through the bone phone. "I'm blind." "Fall back to the rally point," Evan said quietly. "Immediately. Do not engage any further." Tommy was a world-class sniper, but past his prime. If he went head-to-head with Candy, an orphan at the top of her game, she would kill him. Evan heard one of the Tahoes screech away. It barreled upslope, giving Evan's position wide berth. He caught a glimpse of Candy's hair in a side mirror as the SUV bounced across the raised lot. Through the radio, Tommy's voice sounded scratchier than usual. "What about you?" Evan stared at his Ares 1911 where it had landed in the dirt 10 yards away. His backup was out of reach in the trunk behind him. Tommy neutralized. Van Sciver beat it up on the town car with his rifle. "I got you covered," Van Sciver called to his freelancer. "Make the move." A crunch of footsteps signaled the man's emergence from behind the gravel pile. Evan realized what Van Sciver's countermove was, the genius of it turning his insides ice water cold. He heard the clang of footsteps on metal rungs, then the door to the elevated operator's cabin of the crane hinged open and slammed shut. Evan was finished. He still owed Tommy an answer. He set a finger on the bone phone and said, "I'll be fine." "You're clear?" Tommy asked. Evan swallowed. "I'm clear." "Falling back," Tommy said. "Call me for extraction." The Tahoe creaked as Van Sciver posted up and slotted a fresh 20-round mag into the big rifle. "Sure thing," Evan said. His mouth was dry. "And Tommy?"
"What, pal?"
"Thanks for everything."
73. The Black Hereafter. Joey stood at the edge of the fifth floor, the poured concrete slab solid underfoot, the base jumping pack snugged to her back, fist gripping the ripcord. The sound of gunfire carried up, pops muffled by the concrete wall and the roar of traffic beyond. She picked her spot across the 14 lanes of traffic, a parking lot glistening with shattered glass. The city had started to granulate with dusk. Night wasn't far off, and blackness would aid in her escape. From her perch, she'd watched most of the action unfold. Tommy had rolled off the roof of the Oriana house and disappeared well before Candy McClure had forged upslope in the jeep. Her pursuit would be in vain. Tommy had too much of a jump on her. That left Evan, pinned down without a weapon, facing off against Van Sciver and a freelancer. Last Joey had peeked. They'd taken up strategic positions at a 90-degree spread, vectoring in at him from two angles he couldn't cover even if he had a gun. But he was Orphan X, and Orphan X always found a way. And so she donned the backpack and retreated to the far edge as promised. Now she was here, freedom a single leap away. A mural decorated the far wall of the freeway, visible to the eastbound passing cars. Cesar Chavez and Gandhi, Martin Luther King and Nelson Mandela. A cacophony of quotations and languages painted the drab concrete, but one sentence in particular stood out. If you've got nothing worth dying for, you've got nothing worth living for. She read it twice, felt it pull at something deep inside her. Pushing away the sensation, she took a few backward steps to allow herself a running start. Then she heard another sound, a large piece of machinery rumbling to life. At the dead center of the uppermost slab, she hesitated. Run. Or turn. She closed her eyes, took a deep breath, heard a voice that was part Jack's, part Evan's, part her own.
The sixth commandment, it said. Question orders.
She turned. Easing to her former position, she had a perfect vantage on the scene below. Van Sciver in the embrace of the armored Tahoe, rifle raised. Evan hidden behind the increasingly frayed town car, his 1911 well out of reach on the ground. The slewing unit of the colossal crane below squealed, the horizontal jib lurching into motion. The freelancer had climbed up into the operator's cab and swiveled it into position, directly below the orange cage of the raised platform lift. Directly below her. The freelancer worked the controls, getting the hang of the massive unit. The jib rotated unevenly and then halted, aligned with the town car. The massive steel lifting hook lowered, scooping up the carry cables of an I-beam. The I-beam rose. But only a few feet off the ground. The trolley engaged, running the load out from the crane's center. The I-beam traveled a few yards, nosing the town car like a rhino checking out a jeep full of safari-goers. The town car tilted up onto the tires of its left side, not quite high enough to expose Evan. Then it settled back down. The load hadn't acquired sufficient momentum. The crane screeched, the trolley pulling the I-beam away from the car toward the mast. It drew back and back, like the wind-up of a massive battering ram. The town car stood directly in its path, an empty can awaiting a mallet. If you've got nothing worth dying for, you've got nothing worth living for. Joey let the camo backpack slip from her shoulders. She stepped onto the platform lift and clicked the big red button to lower herself. Evan knew what was coming, and this was not an instance where that was a good thing. The crane hummed, its motor a low-grade earthquake that rumbled the ground. He stretched his neck, watched the I-beam reach the end of the track, and pause, swaying mightily, preparing its journey back along the jib and into the side of the town car. Once it went, the car would be swept away, leaving Evan bare. The I-beam stilled, readying to reverse course. Evan calculated 5 possible moves, but they all ended the same way, with Van Sciver putting a tight grouping through his torso. When the time came, Evan would choose one of them. His instinct and training demanded as much. But this time, he already knew the outcome. Riding the platform lift, Joey watched the I-beam dangling way below the jib. It had reached the terminus of its backswing. Her thumb jammed the down button so hard her knuckle ached. She willed the orange cage to descend faster, but it kept its infuriatingly steady pace. The freelancer was partially visible inside the operator's cab, a downward slice of forehead and one cheek. The noise of her descent was lost beneath the roar of the motor driving the slewing unit. The platform lift inched lower, the operator's cab coming up below. The freelancer's hands were locked around 2 joystick-like controllers. He threw his right fist forward. The I-beam rocketed toward the town car an instant before Joey's orange cage struck the top of the cab. It was too late. Evan couldn't see anything, but he felt the rush of a forced breeze, the air shuddering as the I-beam swept for the town car. 5 seconds to impact. Now 4. He had to go for the backup 1911 in the trunk, even if it meant getting shot by Van Sciver. He sprang up, painfully aware of the full presentation of his critical mass, and grabbed the Ares where it lay against the carpeted cargo space. Through the holes in the raised trunk, he could see Van Sciver 20 yards away, shielded by the armored door of the Tahoe.
He expected to be staring at the full circle scope of the rifle, the last sight he'd ever see. But miraculously, Van Sciver wasn't looking at him. He was aiming up at the lowering platform lift, firing round after round. His shots sparked off the edge of the lift as it crushed into the top of the operator's cab. The freelancer leapt out of the cabin an instant before it crumpled and gave way. As the lift continued its descent, he began monkeying down the caged rungs, staying ahead of it. Was that Joey riding the orange cage down? Before Evan could react, the I-beam swept in, a massive blur in his peripheral vision. He snatched the backup gun from the trunk and whipped down out of sight. One instant the town car was at his back, solid as a bulwark. The next it was gone, Evan alone on the open stretch of dirt. The mass of metal had hurtled close enough to him that its wake spun him around onto one knee. He achieved a single instant of clarity. The freelancer, at the base of the tower, jumping free of the rungs, a second or two away from being able to aim his rifle. Van Sciver, 20 yards away, his scar rotating back to lock on Evan. In an instant, Evan would have 2 targets on his head from 2 angles, a 7-10 bowling split. Evan got off the X, throwing himself to the side, hitting a roll, elbows locked, Ares extended before him. He had 9 shots to spend, 8 in the mag, 1 in the spout. Upside down, Evan aimed at the space beneath the Tahoe's door. One of Van Sciver's rounds flew past his ear, trailing heat across his cheek. Evan kept rolling, lining the sights, the target spinning like a vinyl record. He fired 1, 2, 3, 4 shots before a round clipped the back of Van Sciver's boot, tearing free a chunk of durable nylon and Achilles tendon. Van Sciver grunted but kept his feet, cranking off another round that buried itself in the dirt 2 inches from Evan's nose, blowing grit in his eyes. Evan shot at the armored door. The impact drove the door back into the frame, hammering Van Sciver with it. The blow disoriented him, the rifle joggling in his hands. Evan used the pause to flip himself into a kneeling position. The freelancer now stood in a sniper's standing pose, feet slightly spread, right elbow tucked tight to the ribs to support the rifle, butt held high on his shoulder to bring the scope into alignment. Evan fired through the scope atop the rifle and blew out the back of the man's head. He quick pivoted to Van Sciver, who was hauling his weapon into position again, still protected by the armored door. Evan advanced and shot the door again, slamming Van Sciver backward into the truck. The rifle spun free. Evan pressed his advantage, firing again into the door. Van Sciver banged into the Tahoe once more, this time spilling partially out from his position of cover. Van Sciver's head was protected by the armored door, but his body, made bulkier by a Kevlar vest, sprawled in full view. Night was coming on, but Evan was close enough that visibility was not a problem. He had 1 shot left. He lined the sights on the gap in the body armor where the arms usually hung. Van Sciver's tumble had twisted the vest around his torso, the vulnerable strip pulled toward his belly. Evan fired his last round. The fabric frayed as the bullet entered Van Sciver's abdomen. A clod of air left him. Blood poured from the hole. Evan kept the pistol raised, images spinning through his mind. Jack leaning back in his armchair and closing his eyes, letting the opera music move right through him. Young Evan at his feet, soaking it in by osmosis, these strange and beautiful sounds from another life that was now somehow his as well. Van Sciver fought himself up to a sitting position against the Tahoe. Evan cast his empty gun aside and advanced on him. The fallen rifle lay between them. He could pick it up, stave in Van Sciver's skull with the butt. Firelight playing across Jack's face in the study as he read Greek mythology out loud to Evan, his excitement contagious, the stories coming to life. Winged horses and impossible labors, gorgons and demigods, underworlds and Elysian fields. Van Sciver pressed his hands to his stomach. He'd been gunshot, the bullet entering the mid-abdominal area north of the belly button and beneath the xiphoid, where the ribs came together. Judging from the rush of bright red seeping through Van Sciver's hands, the bullet had severed the superior mesenteric artery. It was held together by the Kevlar vest and little else.
The vest just might prove sufficient to hold him together long enough to get to a surgical suite, which was why Evan would beat him to death with his bare hands. Jack, stepping off into the black hereafter, not a trace of fear in his eyes. What could have filled him with such peace as he'd spun to his impact?